Now, a new study into familicide and domestic homicides has recommended that a national database should be established for reporting on violent family deaths. Familicide is classified as a multiple victim homicide incident in which the killer's partner or ex-partner and one or more children are slain. The review, chaired by Solicitor Maura Butler, was asked to recommend how relatives affected by these harrowing crimes could be better supported, and also advises on appropriate protocols and guidelines for state services. So this is a big report, and we're really at this point just giving initial reactions to it. And with that in mind, I'm delighted that Dr. Marie Hainsworth, manager of the Donegal Domestic Violence Service, has accepted our invite just to give an initial reaction. Thank you very much, Marie, for joining us.
Thank you, Greg, for having me on.
So what's your immediate takeaway from your readings of this report so far?
Well, I've only just kind of got hold of it. I mean, it is 500 pages long, the report, so it covers all aspects. It's quite a broad-ranging report, so I think the media has been highlighting, you know, some of the areas of the work of the report and picking up on some of the maybe more tangible, immediate things that could be done. But the recommendations cover everything. They cover from how agencies should interact. They look at what the needs are of families. They look at recommendations around interagency working. They look at, you know, risk assessment. So it of things. So it is a kind of a very comprehensive report, and it will take a while, I think, to process and look at the implications of it.
A lot of the reporting on it to date is after the fact. And is that the focus of this report, Marie?
Yeah, I think what it's looked at is it has kind of, I mean, a big focus of it has kind of gone into what the needs of families are. And it would be, you know, I suppose maybe beyond the remit of this report, but it's certainly what domestic homicide reviews need to do is look at what were the factors leading up to these events. Because obviously for every family that's bereaved, you know, they would much prefer that the work had been put in and not allowed this situation to come to bear. So that's what the purpose of domestic homicides are about, and I'm not sure where the recommendation is at the moment in terms of how that should be pursued and to make sure that we're learning from this. It does talk about risk assessment, but we can't work with risk assessment until we actually know what it is that we need to be assessing for risk on. So there's a lot of work yet to be done, and this report is maybe just outlining the different areas of work, and I imagine different sections of different areas are going to have to take on certain different recommendations.
Do you see the importance of a national database? Because, you know, there are certainly big gaps in data, not least in, say, for instance, suicide figures. And we know the network of coroners around the country are currently working on that. But what's your reaction to news of the establishment of a national database?
Well, more, you know, I'm not actually sure how it would be implemented, but the more data we have, obviously, the more we can look into it. But it's what you do with that data. There's other data that they're not talking about, such as we know within domestic abuse relationships, often suicide can be an outcome for victims. And that at the moment isn't included in any of these statistics. So it's not just what happens in the moment and we can directly attribute to domestic violence, but it's all the side effects. And, you know, certainly suicide of victims through domestic abuse is an area that they do include in domestic homicide reviews in the UK and in some other. So it's how do we pull together all of that, given that the way it's reported and recorded as a death may not necessarily be accessible in that way. You know, it may not be recorded. So it's all to do with how it's recorded, how it's passed on, how it's shared, and then how it's stored. So there needs to be consistency across all of those areas. And we know within the Guard we have to do a lot of work about breaking down what call-outs are for, so that domestic violence is not just a domestic call-out, but we know exactly what it was for, and we know then whether there were repeat call-out. So the management of data and how things are recorded is as much behind all of this as anything else. And then you can put together a database.
Yeah, I find myself reflecting on conversations we've had in terms of the early signs that someone could carry out a very violent act. I'm minded of conversations I've had with survivors whereby they weren't able to have any knowledge of maybe, for example, mental health supports or other supports that an eventual perpetrator was receiving, so didn't know exactly what was going on. Is it inappropriate for me to bring this in, that in as part of this conversation, Marie, or does that fall into a different area of how we try and prevent these types of atrocities?
No, it is relevant, but I mean, the other area that I'm just reading a domestic homicide review at the moment in from Northern Ireland, where the abuser was actually an adult child, so all the information around his health and well-being were known by the family, and yet still a homicide occurred. So, you know, it's not just about, as I say, it's also the agencies knowing and being able to put in place risks. So what they're highlighting, even in this case where it's an adult child to an older parent, agencies were all working on different aspects of the family. You know, they had child support services, they had mental health services, but each was working in their own, with their own focus. Nobody was looking at the overall picture about what was going on in that family. And it's who is pulling together all this information is the key piece, you know, and you can't just rely on families to do that. There should be somebody within a state agency that is able and has the expertise to pull all of that together and say, in isolation, each one of these things may be low risk, but put them all together and now you've suddenly got a very different dynamic. And it's that bit of it that is missing at the moment, and is allowing situations to just fall through the gaps like that.
And it's very important, if we are being seen to do something, that we actually do something correctly, and something that actually will benefit, you know, rather than, oh, well, that's happening, but nothing really comes of it. And we see that all too often. A consultative group is to be established to help implement these recommendations. And it's very important that their voices are listened to, isn't it?
I think so. But I think they need to be talking to people on the ground as well. They need to be looking at, I mean, I know it comes up even within our own work about information sharing, GDPR, I think, put the fear on agencies around information sharing. And we need to now look at protocols around how do we know what information needs to be shared, when it needs to be shared, and who you're sharing it with. And not just with other agencies, it needs to be shared within agencies as well. So you haven't got different workers going out to a family not aware of what the other worker is aware, you know, has kind of witnessed or is aware of. And the link up then between, you know, adult safeguarding, child safeguarding, safety and protection within the Gardaí, and then you've got the other support agencies working with families, mental health, addiction services, domestic violence services. There are numerous agencies and partners, and the complexity of cases now means that those agencies need to sit together and look at how we can not just work together, but how we can understand risk within our own topic area, and then how it links into other people's. You know, what information does your service need from mine in order to complete your risk assessment? They're the kind of questions we need to now be looking at.
A caller here says, as someone who was involved in a family situation where someone was killed and then the person took their own life, I feel we very much were abandoned after the event, and that needs to change. No community person, no religious person, no local councillor or TD, no person involved in counselling services. Gardaí handed us a card with a help number on it, and that was it. Society, they feel, abandoned us. Their names were not mentioned to us, but we were grieving. I do feel there needs to be more openness after these events happens. And that's a real life account there of a listener.
Yeah, and I think this report kind of looks at that. It spoke with a lot of families, you know, about what the level of support was after the incident, and it was very clear that there was very little. And I think, if the more confident communities can be in agencies about talking about these issues, the more we're going to be able to offer that kind of compassionate response afterwards, as much as doing the risk assessment beforehand. You know, it's not a topic, and I think people get scared and run away from it, and we need to embrace this, and we need to work with people. And that way, I think then we can maintain that humanity and compassion that families need in the aftermath of events like this.
Okay. Dr. Marie Hainsworth, as always, thanks for your time today. And Marie is manager of Donegal Domestic Violence Services. If you want to have your say on that, you know the contact details, don't you? A caller says, we were chatting to Orla earlier on about her visit to a beach and it was a mess. This caller says, I know that beach in Dunree Orla is talking about, known to locals as Port Ban. There is no access for cars onto the beach. The person has to walk 500 metres from the road to the beach. It's just the height of laziness and disrespect that they carried the stuff down there for their day out. They should carry it back up again. Plain and simple, having no bin on a beach is no excuse for throwing rubbish at their backsides. Indeed. And I just feel that if you're the type of person inclined to leave it there Are you going to take it as far as a bin? And if that bin is full, are you going to say, oh, right, we better take it home, or you're just going to dump it at your backside at the bin? Redumping, a caller says it's unfair to have assumed that the perpetrators were from Derry just because they had a Northern registered vehicle. What these people did was completely wrong, but to name Derry when there is no proof that they came from there is not fair. And I did point out that as well, that we can't presume because they're a vehicle has a Northern Irish plate that it is from Derry or Tyrone for that matter. But that was her opinion and Tracy's opinion. And of course, emotions are running high because someone did it. And I really think that the point that Tracy was saying, it wasn't to sort of criticise that person being from Northern Ireland. It was to say that if they were from Northern Ireland, they could have taken the rubbish home and dumped it for free. So, you know, rather than us, I don't think we're going to get anywhere if we sort of start knocking heads on this. So there, what Tracy was saying is that if they were from Northern Ireland, they could have got rid of it for free. If they weren't from Northern Ireland, they still dumped it on the side of the road and should have taken it home with them. Okay, we'll be back with Wellness Wednesday after these. Pleased to welcome onto the programme Georgina O'Shea. Good morning to you, Georgina.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm good. How are you feeling?
I'm good, thank you.
Very good. And congratulations on the birth of your beautiful baby girl, Riley. How is Riley?
She's doing fantastic. She's thriving, which is great. Just trying to get used to, I suppose, the night feeds and the sleep this night. But other than that, she's fantastic.
I was asking, how is Riley? I should ask, how is Mum, really, Georgina? How old's Riley now?
She's 2 weeks old today.
Oh, wow. So just brand new.
She is.
Okay, that's lovely. Now, you shared your miracle, really, Riley is to you, I'm sure, Georgina, because it was a long, hard road to this point for you and your partner.
Oh, it was. It was very tough, very hard. But a little miracle came, I suppose, and she's here now with us. So it was, I suppose, worth it in the long run when you hold her in your arms.
And Georgina, Riley's your second child, is that correct?
Yeah, so I gave birth to my son in 2004. So Leon is turning 19 next month. I was a teenage mom. So when I gave birth to Leon, everything was quite straightforward. The labour was straightforward. There was no complications. So there was never any indication, I suppose, that things could go wrong for us. And then subsequently after we had Leon, he was about 2.5 when we had our first miscarriage. We went to the doctors. They just told us, you know, it happens to most women in their lifetime. They had the experience, a minimum of one miscarriage, and that my age was in my favour. So not to worry. And within the next 2 years, we had another two miscarriages. Again, we went to the doctor with concerns. And they were just played on deaf ears, I suppose, because of our age. So we moved to Cork about a year after. And again, we fell pregnant. And I was sitting in the doctor's surgery and the doctor did the pregnancy test and it came back positive. And she had said to me, you know, oh, congratulations. And I just looked at the doctor and started crying. And I just said to her, you know, you've been commiserations. I've had three miscarriages. This is going to be the same. She was the first doctor ever to listen to us and take her concerns seriously, I suppose. So she put us in contact with Professor Keelan O'Donoghue in the CUMH. And Keelan straight away brought us in. She done all the checks and tests on both Ken and I. Everything came back perfect. Everything was working as it should be. Levels were normal. So we sent my files to the States for doctors over there to kind of review them and see were we missing anything. And they said, you know, it could be my womb rejecting the pregnancy or it could be my immune system just because I'm rhesus negative blood group. Mm-hmm. So we done things to try and shock the womb and to shock the immune system. What they were in trial at the time, they didn't work. So 4 years ago, we fell pregnant, the last pregnancy before Riley. And everything was going to plan. The bloods were good, everything. There was a little bit of hope. But unfortunately, it ended up in an ectopic pregnancy where I lost one of my fallopian tubes.
Mm-hmm.
So when I came out of surgery, the doctor had come around to speak to me and just said, you know, my other fallopian tube was badly scarred and the likelihood of me carrying full term or carrying a normal pregnancy was very unlikely. Just because of the scarring, it would, there was a higher chance of it being another ectopic.
Yeah.
So at that point, Ken and I sat down and we were like, you know, when your life is at risk, you have to look at things in a different perspective, I suppose. So we decided, you know, to back off and kind of stop trying and just live life, I suppose. We were teenage parents, so everything we missed out on, we started doing over the last 4 years. And then little Miss Riley, in September last year, we took a pregnancy test and this little miracle, we were pregnant with her. We got onto the hospital straight away, and to be fair, the care they gave us was second to none. They got us in for scans every 2 weeks. They kept a very close eye on my pregnancy and on myself. But the first scan, we actually seen Riley on the scan, which was something we had never seen throughout the 23 miscarriages.
Yeah.
So the second scan, then 2 weeks later, we saw her heartbeat.
Wow.
So Ken then was hopeful. He was positive. He was like, okay, this is it. This is going to be it. I didn't accept it until I was about 23 weeks. By that time, I knew then that we had a viable pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
So if I gave birth any time after, I knew there was a chance of survival. 30 weeks then came, and that's where it got very tough mentally. I was so close, but yes, so far.
Yeah.
So the fear of losing her at that point was very real. Good luck, we got through it.
Yeah, because
and
I presume,
here I'd say,
we'll talk about that, and that's fantastic. But just the emotional side of it, things for you, and perhaps not even being able to enjoy the pregnancy with Riley, even once it advanced to such a point. Because how did you deal emotionally, because as you say, lots of people listening to this program, both women, men and women, and people react to it different ways, of course, and respect that, will have gone through a miscarriage and they'll know how that feels. But for you, I mean, even at what point did getting pregnant fill you with fear of what you would see as the inevitable? Do you know what I mean? And how did you protect yourself in all of that?
Well, when we first found out we were pregnant with Riley, I think because I'd been through so much and my coping mechanism, I suppose, was to work. So every time I had a miscarriage, it was throw myself into work, just keep myself mentally busy that my body copes with it. So by the time that I have time to think about it, I can heal myself, I suppose. And you're right, everyone deals in different ways. A lot of the miscarriages previous would have been kind of a daze for me. It was just, I remember I just worked all hours and just kind of put my head, as long as my head was kept occupied, I was good. With Riley, when I found out I was pregnant, even though it was the clearest pregnancy test we had, from the word get-go, there was definitely positive signs. I think I just kept in the back of my head, don't get excited because we know how this is going to end. So I think that's how I protect myself, is by not bonding and not connecting,
yeah,
if you like, with the pregnancy. And that was the way it was, even when I had a growing bump and,
yeah,
you know, when we got over to 12 weeks, it was still, there was a disconnect there from me and the baby.
Yeah.
I had to protect myself. And that was my main mental state, I suppose. It was like, we need protection. So I think I disconnected from the pregnancy right up until 23 weeks. I didn't enjoy the first 23 weeks, but I didn't regret them either.
Yes.
You know, I knew I was pregnant. I didn't feel what every other woman would have felt, you know, the movements and stuff like that.
Mm.
I didn't connect with them whatsoever. But then from 23 weeks, it was beautiful. It was really nice just to be able to connect and talk to my bump and
Yeah. And in terms of how the 23 miscarriages and I don't know how other people interacted with you or what do you say or what did they say or you know because we know we can be clumsy in a once-off situation, but with you this is through much of your adult life, of course, Georgina. How was that, or did you keep it to yourselves, or what was the story?
Miscarriage is a very lonely place for both male and female. It's kind of a taboo subject, and I'm not sure why, and I don't understand why.
Georgina, I've talked about this before. We kind of create it ourselves because we won't discuss a pregnancy until after 12 weeks because we sort of, because there is that... we haven't as a society learned how to discuss a pregnancy that ends before that period, if you know what I mean. So we keep it hush, you say nothing to 12 weeks, then you say nothing to the scan. It's that it's almost as if you were to say you had a miscarriage, that there's something associated with it, or people get all awkward. And I think we've just manifested this, and this is where the way we are now. I think we need to get rid of that.
Oh, I agree 100%. Like, when you find out you're pregnant, yes, you're correct, 3 months, women kind of have this thing for 3 months. And again, I think it's, for me personally, why I wouldn't normally tell people is because I'd have to then tell them that I miscarried.
Yep.
And I personally don't do sympathy, and I don't do people feeling sorry for me. I don't deal well with that. So for me, it's like it was easier for me to kind of cope on my own than people to kind of give me sympathy and feel sorry for me, because it wasn't a case of I needed someone to feel sorry for me. Mm. You needed someone to be probably strong more than anything and be like, this is okay.
Yeah.
This happened, you know. And that's what I personally needed, was someone to tell me it's okay. Things will work out. And Ken was that person. But because he was going through it himself, my family were fantastic. They were there every step of the way.
Mm.
But as in outside people, work colleagues, friends, no, there's a taboo. I suppose they don't understand it. And they can be quite hurtful with comments. Like, I would have had comments, why are you putting your body through that? You know, you have one already. Aren't you lucky?
Yeah.
You know, there's certain comments that aren't okay and aren't acceptable. Mm. But
and then you'll have a situation where someone has one miscarriage. People, sometimes we just need to listen rather than say the thing comes to our mind. They'll say, oh, well, it wasn't for you, you can go again. Things like that there, when people are dependent on how they react to it, they could be in the throes of grief. Do you know what I mean? I just think we as a society need to educate ourselves a little bit better on how we talk about things like this, and then we can break down maybe these taboos and secrecy, if it has to be there or what have you.
I think the most powerful question anybody could ask someone going through a miscarriage, whether it be the woman or whether it be the partner, because news are just as important. Mm-hmm. We need to help them too. But I think the most effective question you can ask someone is, are you okay?
Yep.
It's a powerful question to someone. Yeah, it's very powerful. And it just means to that person that's grieving, okay, someone cares.
Now, let's get to the birth then, because Riley weighed in after a 45-minute labour, 7 pounds, 6 ounces. I don't know, because you're doing the hard work, so to speak, what was it like for you? And I can imagine Ken was a wreck at this stage when Riley first made her appearance. Can you talk to us about what it was like for the two of you at that moment?
Oh, like her labour itself, 45 minutes, so it was extremely quick. So I suppose the labour itself just kind of hit us, and we were in a whirlwind. We kind of were in a daze. But when she was born very quickly. I looked up at Ken and I cried. And the only thing I said, I think, for about 10 minutes was, oh my God, we have a baby. She's here. But I remember looking at Ken just as she came out, and his face was soaked with tears. He'd actually been crying since she was coming out. So yeah, there was plenty of tears of joy.
Yeah. And what about you when you finally got to hold her after that? Not just the roller coaster of the pregnancy, but everything that went before it. What was it like for you? Did it feel instantly, I don't know, real? I don't know what to, do you know that it had finally happened for you? How did you feel?
It was day three when I actually realised that, oh, she's here. I think the shock of everything, the shock of the labour didn't so quick. And I think like that emotion and just trying to process, like I was in hospital with her and I was doing the night feed, but it just seemed like a bit of a trance. But day three, it hit home then that, God, we have her. And I think because we were taking her home to our own home house, I think that kind of made it more real for us. But we're enjoying it. It's a little bit tougher, I suppose, than I remember. But we're definitely enjoying it.
And what's Leon's reaction? He's a big brother now.
Oh, he is ecstatic. He's a doting big brother. Mm. He waited 19 years, I suppose, for siblings, because his dad and I come from quite large families, and he never wanted to be an only child. So he waited quite a long time for his little sister to come along. But no, he's over the moon, absolutely over the moon. Mm. And he has his own baby coming in as well in 2 weeks' time.
So how exciting.
It's going to be fun.
Yeah. You might not be able to go to Granny for a babysitter straight away, or wherever you might prefer to call yourself. I think you'll have your hands full. And you, I would say, and I know, you know, emotionally, it's your own business and all, but you've a bit to work through at the moment to process all of this with everything that you've gone through over the last, for the last number of years, and even sort of the mental exhaustion of the pregnancy and now the reality of it and all becoming real. I think you've a bit of, well, I would imagine if I were you, it'll take a while to sort everything out. I would imagine just in terms of, well, wow, okay, here we are.
Oh yeah, for sure. Before Riley had come along, I was a very organized person and had everything kind of all my T's crossed and my I's dotted type of person. That kind of flew out the window a little bit. So just trying to readjust, I suppose, to not being able just to get up in the morning and go out the door to work or go out the door and go and do shopping. He's trying to prepare now.
Just when all of that stuff, maybe the driving Leon around stuff, just when you thought, right, maybe, well, here we are back at square one again. And sure, you wouldn't be anywhere else. Congratulations to you, Georgina, and congratulations to Ken and Leon. And we wish him all the best for the next couple of weeks too. He's going to be up to high dough on multiple levels with his own wee one coming. And it's a lovely story. And that you have your miracle baby, who gave a two-fingered salute to science, because it was the most recent information you got from the medic saying that, look, between the jigs and the reels, it's probably not going to go happen for you. But she had other ideas.
Yeah, she definitely did.
Okay. All right, I'll let you back to it. Take care. Thank you very much indeed. That is Gina O'Shea there.
Business Matters, in association with the ATU Donegal Faculty of Business. If you're a senior manager in the private sector looking to reinforce your leadership skills, ATU are offering a Level 9 Executive MBS in Leadership and Innovation. Call 91-86206 or email donald.hannigan@atu.ie.
Okie doke, we're in studio with Kieran O'Donnell as we preview Highland Radio's Business Matters podcast, which is live for you right now on our website. But before we start shamelessly plugging it, let's talk a little bit of news. Firstly, actually, Kieran, pardon my ignorance, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg.
I'm going to move that mic because I had to... Yeah, just there, because I've had to adjust things.
I'm admiring your T-shirt. You're wearing the Donegal colours there with pride. Ireland and Donegal's DNA.
The hassle I had to get off the council to get this, you wouldn't believe it. There you go.
A great hanger. Well done.
I'm still owed a hoodie, by the way, if John McLaughlin and his team are listening.
Time off the...
Although, you know what?
Time off the October for that.
Well,
ask for another T-shirt and hope for the best.
Yeah, these are, by the way, if anyone's watching, these are actually really quite nice. I like them. It's in your DNA, you know.
Yeah.
Right, okay. Highland Radio Customer Services Awards night. I was genuinely blown away by it, Kieran. I thought it
yeah,
just
same
was
as
amazing.
That, Greg. You know, I say over 550 people attended the Highland Radio's Customer Service Awards in the Mount Airy Eagle. A total of 51 awards presented, held in association with PGIM, which celebrated local businesses and individuals who have consistently demonstrated exceptional commitment to customer satisfaction and excellence in service delivery. Look, everybody made a great effort. There's great buzz, great energy, a massive bit of organisation. So well done to the team at Highland for it.
And
it was
I
a great night.
Their success in Raffo, with Bala Buffet,
Stranola. A few lady tables.
It was just fantastic. Aye. You know, from Inishowen. There's just businesses represented from absolutely everywhere. Everyone looked fantastic, and it was a great buzz. And the social media team here too, by the way, have done some great work in putting up some of the afters on our Instagram and Facebook as well. So check them out too, because... It's just lovely.
It was a great initiative.
Yeah. And I loved how much people enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was a good way to connect and as opposed to sort of meet up with people. The whole thing I thought, Greg, was, you know, people, they're very happy sometimes to leave their business and leave the work behind them and go out and have a good time. So it was great to be part of it.
And take Monday off.
Some people did.
Yeah, it seems so. I left not long after you, Kieran, by the way, so you can take that halo off and put it back in your pocket.
No comment. I can only take your word for it.
I was fresh-faced and... what is it? Fresh-faced? Anyway, I was here Monday morning and did the show proudly. Right, okay. So listen, well done to everyone involved. And there's just absolutely no doubt that that has to be an annual event. Such was the level of success. And the buy-in, you know, 16,000 votes from the public... 1,300 businesses nominated. You know, as I said, I think, I can't remember what I said. Maybe I said it on the radio. You're just 1,300 businesses. I didn't know how many businesses were in Donegal, right? But an awful lot of them were obviously represented. Okay, right. So I think the listeners probably have heard enough about that now. But go on the website and on the socials if you want to see more. Okay, more Irish jobs could become remote.
Yes, around 9,000 Irish jobs could be made more remote if systemic support was implemented. That is according to research conducted by Grow Remote, the social enterprise that advocates for better remote working options in Ireland. Research conducted around remote working in Ireland found that 25% of employees are now working fully remotely. Among the benefits, 84% believe their productivity increased, 60% felt better able to switch off after work, and 61% of 25 to 35 year olds are considering moving to another part of Ireland, which is interesting.
Yeah, it really is. And it ties into some of the census figures too.
Yeah.
Quite a large percentage of, was it 15% of Donegal workers at least part of the time work from home? I know you're talking about
I haven't come across
remotely.
That yet. But
yeah, no, I saw it then. I know working from home and remote working are kind of, they're in the same space, but the stats are probably slightly different. Okay. Good luck making a bed or pulling a pint from home, though. You know what I mean? I think it's all going to settle down and certain industries will
certain
see
industry,
more.
I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's very much targeted at wherever possible. But as you say, it's not possible in every sector.
Well, I've heard some comments from people saying, is it fair? You know, like, is it equitable? Should someone who has to go out and build you your house... and, you know, fix your car. Is it fair that they should have to do that whilst you sit in an office?
I don't think fairness comes into that, Greg. I mean, when you're not comparing like with like at all. If things can be done remotely and if productivity isn't being impacted upon, and if the company, at the end of the day, if the boss is happy with the work that's been done, that's ultimately what it's about in terms of whether it's fair or not.
But then you see, right, you have to then think of the societal impacts it has. You have cities and towns getting quieter. You've got coffee shops closing, restaurants closing.
Yeah.
If more people work at home, and I'm not discouraging it, but if more people work at home, is it an equal society? Because it does affect everybody else's and particularly those that are forced to leave their house to work.
Well, take away the job sector or the roles you're in. The other side that I got thinking about there recently is the fact that if people are working from home, well, if they're not going to be commuting, will they be going to have lunch in their own local cafe or their own restaurant or going for a coffee locally as opposed to buying it in the city? So That disposal income can be spent more locally
or
if they're not travelling.
Could just make a hang sandwich in the house. Who's
correct.
To say? Right,
correct.
Okay. A pub in Glenties on the market?
Yeah, another pub in Donegal has been placed on the market this time. It's Sonny's Bar in Glenties that has been put up for sale. The bar located on Glenties Main Street was recently refurbished and the sale is being handled by Henry Key and Son based in Ballybuffet.
Okay, Food Coast Donegal Strategic Review launched. What's this about?
Yeah, Castle Grove Country House Hotel in Letterkenny was the venue for yesterday's official launch of the Food Coast Donegal Strategic Review 2023-2026. MC for the Donegal Local Enterprise event was Noel Cunningham and guest speakers included Libby Carton of Kenninger Brewing, James Doherty from Sleeve League Distillers, Richard Finney of New Kid Coffee and Hugh Wolhare from Mulroy Bay Mussels Limited.
Nice one. Right, now there's some supports or advice at least for people who may wish to start their own enterprise.
Yeah, just for those, Greg, who missed the Start Your Own Business Bootcamp that was held at the weekend in the Silver Tassie Hotel, the Donegal Local Enterprise Office is running a programme of evening online sessions that are scheduled to start on Tuesday next, that's June the 6th. The programme will guide participants through the various aspects of business and business planning. And for more information, check out the local enterprise office's social media platforms.
And lastly in news, more of us than ever before now have access to high-speed broadband.
Yeah, it's just in relation to the census, Greg, that you mentioned earlier. Almost 80% of households had a broadband internet connection in 2022, up from 71% in 2016 and 64% in 2011. As I say, that's according to the latest census carried out last year in April. So the census population summary results were published yesterday, as you know, and the various sections of the findings, they're going to be sort of drip-fed now over the next 6-7 months. I think there are 8 or 9 reports to come. So I find it sort of strange that they're taking so long to sort of get out every wee bit. I'm not expecting them to come all together, but you do wonder why it's going to take.
I think they're managing the release a bit more than anything, Kieran. You know, that so they'll talk about next month, they'll talk about.
So you take 6 months to get out the findings of your census?
Yeah, I know I don't agree with it, but I think there's a bit of a drip
yeah.
in it, okay? Because they have the info.
Yeah.
You know. Okay, right. Let's take a break. Stay right where you are because we are going to preview the podcast and listen to some of the contributors. So stay right where you are. Right, okay. This week's Business Matters. Can you tell me who you're joined by, Kieran?
Yes, Greg. This week I'm joined by the owner of TC Promotions based on Arranmore Island, Thomas Costello.
He's some operator, Thomas.
He is indeed.
He's some operator.
A native of Arranmore, Thomas began DJing as a 14-year-old in Smugglers Nightclub in 1990 and after a number of years working in construction, which took him to London, Limerick and Dublin, he returned to Donegal and set up TC Promotions in 2012. Thomas was the director of the Mary from Donegal Festival in 2013 and has been entertainment manager at the Pulse and Voodoo Nightclubs in Letterkenny since 2015. In 2020, Thomas added Marquee Hire to his company's list of services. And here he talks about what's entailed when that line of business.
Our festivals were kind of getting bigger and bigger. And I used to hire out the venues unfortunately got too small now and more to host the events. So I then thought, well, let's hire a marquee. So much more to that too. It sounds like, oh, let's just hire it and go for it. But it's not that simple. If you're going to do that, there's so many people has to be involved with a marquee. Like you've got the fire officer, you've got your courts, you get licensing. So I suppose we just tried it, see how it went. And we at the time, like somebody says to me, and you know, back before I bought my own, we were hiring them, they were saying, you get an event management plan. And I said, where do I start an event management plan? But you sit and you work it out. And I suppose I'm very lucky to have my brother helped me out, Frankie. That's massive help. Wouldn't be able to run TC Promotions. Wouldn't even run without him. So we're in a position now where we do the event management plans and we help other people do theirs throughout the place.
It's an interesting story, Kieran.
Yeah, look, Thomas, as I mentioned at the start there, he started a DJ as a 14-year-old. The way he worked in the tunnels for a while and came back. Had a huge love of country music, Greg, and that was passed on from his late father. He still has a love of country music. Decided 3 years ago to go into this area. And just the benefits locally, it can accommodate up to between 700 and 800 people. And in terms of a sit down wedding, you're looking at 220 people. And there are two weddings that are going to take place on Arranmore this year, availing of Thomas's services. So I'm just looking from a local economy point of view, that's a massive boost to the island.
Yeah.
So as I say, he mentioned his brother Frankie, and I suppose when he decided to go into the marquee area, I suppose as he probably got a wee bit of a surprise in terms of the amount of work that's involved.
Well, you're building erecting a venue,
yeah,
and with all of the ups and downs, yeah, of a static venue.
And in terms of event management and all that goes with that, there's a lot of work there. But obviously, he's cracked the system and he's helping others to do it as well. We covered a lot of things as well. He talked about, as well, the challenge and the entertainment industry over the COVID period. He also made reference to the fact that a lot of performers had stopped performing, Greg, and they weren't prepared. They were going to do all the things and they weren't prepared to travel long distances anymore. And I suppose the impact that has had on the whole entertainment industry across the country, you know?
Yeah, and I'll tell you another big problem concert organisers are having is people not buying the tickets as they would because there's nowhere to stay in Dublin.
Yeah.
But also too, sorry, that's a separate thing, but also too, a lot of the roadies, to use a generic term as well, moved on to,
correct,
do different things. Security, yeah, people who work, yeah, in security decided to go and do,
yeah,
different things. So the nuts and bolts of it, of the industry, a lot of people moved away from it now, and it's hard for clubs to get open, to get security staff, and I presume bands, you know, to get all the crews together. So it's an interesting view of all of that. So the full interview with Thomas Costello, who is, let me just say it one more time, some operator, is available now at highlandradio.com or on Spotify or on iTunes. And Business Matters broadcast Sunday, Kieran.
Yeah, after the 6 o'clock news.
And if someone wants to get in touch with the pod, with you, obviously, is what I'm saying, how do they do so?
Yeah, just drop an email, please. Businessmatters@highlandradio.com.
Rightio. So that podcast live for you right now on our website. You can stream it from there or download it to your device if you're going to go out and do a bit of gardening or something and listen to it there. And also, as we say, Spotify and iTunes and the back catalogue for there for you to listen to as well. Kieran O'Donnell, presenter of Business Matters, thank you very much indeed for your time.
Good morning, Greg.
Have a good day. Okay, enjoy the weather. Can I play a couple of requests, if you don't mind? Florence Carty's in Strabane. And Florence, I and your mum, brothers, Paul and Neville, want to wish you a happy birthday. So Florence Carty in Strabane, a very happy birthday to you. Agnes and Shane O'Neill are in Letterkenny, and they want to wish Vicky all the best. Vicky was on with us a little earlier on. She's heading over to participate for Ireland in basketball. Delighted to hear your news today. So apparently Vicky had kept it kind of quiet in and around Kilmacrenan, but Agnes and Shane O'Neill, glad to hear that news. Could you wish Vicky all the best from Olivia? Olivia Ann McGregor. Okay, that's it. Best wishes to you, Vicky. Lots of them coming in too, which is nice. Right, I bought petrol yesterday, says a listener, 1.38. And today I thought before the rise, I'll fill up the wife's car. And the 5 cent, they've already banged it on. It's not supposed to go on until midnight tonight, but they've already added the 5 cent. So much for it happening after midnight, they say. Once again, petrol shops are taking full advantage of their customers. So keep an eye out for us there. You can be the eyes and ears of the listeners. And I think there was some warning from government to not stick it on too soon, but some already have the 5 cent on. Now, maybe there is a reason for it. But that's an extra 5 cent per litre profit, is it not? Unless they bought the petrol in at the newer rate. I don't know. I always try and mitigate for it, but maybe I should stop doing that. Maybe they're just gouging. This listener says, I'm in my 70s and I got a call this morning from someone purporting to be from one of the hospitals that I hadn't paid a bill from a procedure and they needed prompt payment today. Firstly, I have a medical card. And secondly, I've never been to any hospital for anything. They were very insistent that I needed to pay and pay immediately. Luckily, someone else was here and took over the call, at which point the caller hung up. I just want to warn others who may be on their own not to pay this person if they do not owe anything. When I asked what was the procedure I had, he said, this is where, you see, this is where these blighters are clever. So the gentleman thought, right, I can catch this person out and ask him what procedure I had. And the caller said that under GDPR, he couldn't discuss that with the person who was supposed to have had the operation. So they have every trick in the book to trick you into paying. Now, you might say, how would anyone fall for that? Well, if you just got out of hospital, maybe you're still a bit groggy or what have you, and they call 1,000 people a day. Maybe 80 of them have just got out of hospital and they warn of the consequences of not paying the bill. And people in a moment will try and pay, and it's not the amount they take, it's they want your bank details and then they'll clean you out. So thank you for helping us to spread the message on that one. And that is the last contribution for today. We are back with you tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Thank you very much to Caroline Orr, who researched and produced the show.